In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with another Senate candidate here in Illinois in the run-up to the primary in March. We'll be talking with as many candidates as we can, and there is a very crowded field of 9 Republicans and 7 Democrats that are interested in representing their party in the general election. We have an open seat. Illinois' Republican Senator Peter Fitzgerald decided that he would not run again. We're doing what we have tried to do now for many, many years when we're approaching elections, and that is to invite candidates to appear on this program and then to give listeners the opportunity to talk with them. Reporters get to talk to them all the time, but we think it's important for voters to have a little personal contact with candidates as well. This morning we'll be talking with Nancy Skinner. She is one of the Democrats who will be competing in the March primary. Let me tell you a little bit about her. For some time now, she's made her living as a radio talk show host. Beginning in 1997, she had a show on WLS radio coming out of Chicago. That is until this past summer when she announced her candidacy for the Senate and WLS fired her. She now co-hosts a nationally syndicated program called Good Day USA, which airs on 380 radio stations across the country, including 6 in Illinois. She has a business degree from University of Michigan and a background in environmental consulting. Following the floods of 1993, she persuaded the folks in Valmeyer to rebuild off the floodplain using the best environmental and design principles available. She put together a team. Several federal agencies and the White House also got involved. And the town and its mayor received a presidential award for the effort. She's joining us this morning by telephone. So this is the opportunity for people who are listening to ask the questions about the things that are most important to them. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. I do also want to mention real quick that this week there will be 2 radio debates involving candidates in this race. The one tonight at 6:30 will involve the Republican candidates for U.S. Senator from Illinois, and then tomorrow night the Democratic candidates will have a debate, and that will also be at 6:30, and we'll have live coverage here on AM 580 and also online, will.uiuc.edu. Ms. Skinner, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Hey, thank you, David. I liked your introduction. Whoever that woman was, she has my vote.
Well, you'll have the opportunity to exercise that choice on the 16th of March.
I will. Won't that be something to vote for yourself, the United States Senate?
What got into your head that made you decide that you were going to run for the Senate?
Well, it's a journey. My life has been a journey, David, and I've been on the front lines of progressive causes my whole adult life. You mentioned a few of those things. I got a degree in business and finance, and I could have gone to Wall Street and made a bunch of money. In retrospect, I could have made $40 million, and my race would have been much easier. but I didn't. I had an incident in my life. My sister-in-law died of melanoma skin cancer at the age of 34. And her doctor said to me at the time that he believed that it had something to do with the ozone layer. He was seeing all these young people dying of this disease that he had never seen before. So I threw myself into the study of what was going on in the environment with the ozone layer and global warming and the rest of it, and decided I would use my business career to work on environmental issues, and that would be an honorable career. And I did that for 10 years. As you mentioned, I helped rebuild flood communities down in Valmeyer and Pattonsburg, Illinois, after 1993. And I worked in Chicago to help launch what's called the Chicago Climate Exchange to deal with global warming using a market-based mechanism. But then I got into the media because I was so upset about how these issues were being unfairly portrayed in the media. There would be like 6 paid scientists from industry who would say that global warming wasn't happening, and the media would report it as if we don't know. They would say some say global warming is happening and some say it isn't, when the vast majority of scientific consensus suggested that it was. And it wasn't just that issue, David. It was issue after issue. Democrats, I heard, especially on radio, were constantly demonized, feminazis and environmentalist wackos and liberal and tax and spend, and it was a constant refrain that I think the right wing has been working on for 2 decades. And I decided that that was where the battle for the public's hearts and mind was, and that was in the media. So I got into the media. I have become the most widely heard Democrat on talk radio in America. And then this part of my journey, the reason I'm running for the Senate, your original question was, well, why are we losing? Why are we losing the White House and Congress and the Supreme Court when the American public agrees with Democrats on each of the issues, education, health care, the environment, and even the economy now? So why have we lost? And it's because the Republicans have mastered the media and the message, in my view, and Democrats don't know how to frame debates. They don't have enough courage to stand up to Republicans. For instance, in the war, I think too many Democrats voted for the war because they're afraid of being called unpatriotic. Too many Democrats voted for the Bush tax cuts because they were afraid of being called a tax and spend liberal. And too many Democrats voted for a mythical procedure called partial birth abortion because they were afraid to defend a woman's reproductive rights. So, two reasons. I think that this is the kind of candidate we need to start winning elections again. Candidates who understand that media and message matters. How we frame the debate, number one, and with the skills to communicate to the American public and capture their attention. And I'm the only one in my race, both fields, actually both sides, that has been in the crucible of this national media environment, and I know how to speak in 30-second sound bites, although this went on for a minute and a half.
Well, that's okay. We don't expect guests on this particular program to speak in 30-second sound bites.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you another question. We're hoping that at least we'll put the invitation out to all of these candidates, this big crowded field, and we'll see how many we can have. The very first one we did yesterday, and that was one of the Republicans, it was Steve Rauschenberger, who's a member of the Illinois Senate right now. And it seemed very important to him. He wanted to make the point about himself that he was the only one of the Republican candidates that had held elected office. And I'm sure that that's the kind of thing that does come up in campaigns. If you have people who have run before and have been elected and people who haven't, the people that have had said, well, you know, one thing you got to remember about me is I've got legislative experience. Now, I would assume that you would make the argument that that's not that important. That someone would say, well, you know, Nancy Skinner is a fine person, but she's never been elected to anything.
Well, you know, we have a lot of people in Congress right now, Democrats, with lots of legislative experience, and we're still out completely outside, isolated, no power whatsoever. And let me tell you a little insight here. This is where I think Democrats have to look at things differently. We're living, David, in a whole new political reality. And this is something I say to Democratic Party people and insiders. And we're playing by two different sets of rules here. Legislative experience doesn't matter as much as it used to. In fact, in many cases, it can be used against you. My brother-in-law ran for Congress last year from Michigan, the 11th District of Michigan, and it was an open Senate seat. President Bush came in and raised a couple $1 million for his opponent, and they went on TV. My brother-in-law was a local mayor, and they went on TV saying, meet Kevin Kelly. He raised your taxes. Well, he didn't raise taxes. He lowered taxes. So we went with Senator Levin down to the TV station with the millage rates and said, you have to pull this ad. It's completely in contradiction of the facts. The TV station said, as long as it says paid for by, it's paid political advertising, and we can't touch it. So people, and of course Kevin lost, they went negative with that commercial till the day of the election. People believe what they see on TV. And we started to look at, I'm very close with the UAW and the president, and we started to look at all these races across the country and saw the same pattern with Max Cleland in Georgia, where they changed his record and morphed him into Saddam Hussein. When you have enough money, your legislative record can be held against you. Nobody can say, I voted to raise their taxes, that's for sure. They can call me a liberal if they want to call me, you know, that's what they're doing with John Kerry now. They're going to use that old trick. And I say, okay, if you want to take on the political force in this country that brought us the 5-day work week and Social Security and Medicare and clean air and clean water and the two greatest periods of economic growth we've ever known, bring it on. That's what I say. But certainly not there in my race, there aren't many people with legislative experience, and I don't think it's a requirement. In fact, I think it can be a detriment. We have to look for new candidates, and this is the case I always make. We have been picking candidates who we know or who we owe, and that's sort of the old style. Republicans recruit candidates who can win, and they look at a whole host of factors, and we aren't doing that, and I think that's my message. Look anew at this field. Let's see who can win. If it is Jack Ryan who emerges in this race in November, which one of us Democrats are going to have the best chance to go up against this investment banker turned inner city school teacher who looks like a movie star?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Nancy Skinner. She is one of seven Democrats that will compete in the primary on March 16th to represent their party in the race for U.S. Senate from Illinois. This is the seat that's now held by Peter Fitzgerald, who decided he would not run again. So we have an open seat here, and we have a lot of candidates, and as many as would like to be here on the show, we put the invitation out, and we'll give you the opportunity to talk with them. Questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in here, there's some issue that you'd like to ask about. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana, folks, where we are. But, of course, anywhere else in the state of Illinois that you can hear us, if it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. The call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. The president has now put his budget proposal for fiscal 2005 on the table, and his spending priorities are clear and already have drawn a lot of criticism for the fact that there are increases for both military spending and homeland security, but cuts, or at least level spending, in most everything else. I expect that you've had a chance to look at this. What do you think about the president's spending priorities?
There's a pattern here, David. Deficits don't matter. We've heard that for a while now. And now we're hearing weapons of mass destruction don't matter. Doesn't matter if we found them. Hell, last time around, your vote didn't matter, right? So there's a pattern here. And you know what? It does matter. Deficits do matter. This administration is so fiscally reckless. I can't believe that they're getting away with it. Luckily, there are some conservatives that are starting to raise some cane about it. You know, these estimates are still understated in this budget he released yesterday. The CBO did a study last fall with more realistic assumptions. This budget number that they put out has unrealistic assumptions. That says that we're not going to increase any discretionary spending. It doesn't include any military costs for Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. If you go to last fall, where the CBO did their alternative scenarios, looking at more realistic, as in status quo spending and whatnot, and war spending, the deficit over the next 10 years is going to be $10 trillion. $10 trillion. That is Banana Republic material. In fact, the International Monetary Fund has warned that our deficits are so large in the U.S. that they're threatening to destabilize the global economy, both our actual deficit and our trade deficit. So what happens is the President Bush can talk about tax cuts, but really what it was a tax deferral, because we're going to have to pay those taxes. Our children are going to have to pay those taxes, or if you're still young, you'll be paying for it later in your life. So it's not a tax cut. You can't ring up a debt this large and expect that at some point, especially because Social Security is going to go cash negative in 2017, and by law, I don't think most people realize this, when the surpluses dry up and it starts going into deficit, you can't pay Social Security benefits. That's part of the law. So we're going to have to tax people in order to provide that benefit to keep it going. So it's a tax deferral. We need a whole new approach to fiscal responsibility. I think it's pretty clear. This idea that Republicans are more fiscally responsible has now been thoroughly discredited. With Bush 1, it took Clinton and Gore 8 years to pay down the debt and to put us on the path to fiscal responsibility. In fact, we were all arguing about how to spend the surplus, if you can remember how bizarre that was not too long ago. And once again, this phony supply-side economics, that the voodoo economics, as even President Bush 1 called it, was put into place by President Bush 2. Mm. And the result is the same.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? First, Belgium. It's a community which is over near Danville, not that far from us. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask a guest maybe a very pointed question. Do you know where Schuyler County is, ma'am? How about Vermilion County, Edgar County, Piatt County? What are you going to do for downstate Illinois?
Okay, that's a very good question. And the essential part of my platform is just this: jobs and the economy. That is the most central issue that we're facing here in Illinois and across America, because I believe what we've done with our trade policies over the last 20 years, NAFTA, GATT, WTO, the rest of them, is we're exporting our middle class jobs overseas. Now, you cannot compete with a dollar a day labor in foreign countries. So here's my plan. I believe, one, we have to re-engineer all those trade agreements, so it's not a race to the bottom, it's a race to the top. And I have specific solutions in each of these areas, David. I am the only candidate that offers really big, bold, new ideas on how we'll solve some of these problems. So we change those trade agreements, but then, two, I believe we need to invest here in industries that are not easily transferable to overseas. And one of the industries that I think deserves the most investment is the hydrogen fuel cell industry. Now, this is a zero-polluting technology. It can be used to run our cars and heat our homes and our businesses. So it would result in great, clean manufacturing jobs. And as a matter of fact, I've said this publicly many times, I think the most important place to start to position those jobs, especially if I'm the senator that is really triumphing this proposal, would be in downstate Illinois. But also, this is derived from agricultural byproducts, hydrogen can be. I also believe that we need to add into the mix other biofuels like ethanol and switchgrass. When I helped redevelop the communities in downstate Illinois, and I was the only candidate who was downstate Illinois, all these other candidates were going through law school or in Wall Street, I was in the flood zones in Valmire, Illinois, as a private citizen who volunteered my time to get down there and help these people rebuild their communities. And what we did is we looked at all kinds of different economic opportunities, including what we called pig power. And what that was we looked at taking the manure from these big factory farms and hog farms, using it in an anaerobic generator to create methane gas, which you could then use to produce electricity. And the economics were stunning. We had so much manure, in other words, methane gas, that we could put back into the system. Not only could we light up the entire town, but it would produce millions of dollars in economic revenues. This is the kind of out-of-the-box thinking, I think. Wind energy. The windmills have tremendous potential for farmers who have the land for them. There's a whole host of economic opportunities, and that's the major part of my platform.
Well, ma'am, you sure can talk fast. Thank you very much.
I have a lot to say. Yes, I do talk fast.
We have another caller here. We'll go next to Matt Toon, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I am the same way the other fellow is. You just take my breath away. You're so fast. The only comment I wanted to make for you, and maybe for food for your thought, was that there's only really a couple of things in the budget that they could really affect. I mean, that have a major effect, and one is Social Security, and the other is defense. And then there's also the interest on the debt. Could you spend some time and do the math on the interest on the debt? Because when you're talking about that $10 trillion or that ungodly number, what that does to our economy, because you're talking
sure.
about...
Good point. I do know those numbers. By 2009, at the rate we're going, with the Bush fiscal policies, by 2009, we will be paying more for interest on the debt than we are paying for all discretionary spending in the budget, from education to science, to you name it, the National Institutes of Health, to education, everything. Interest payments will be larger, all discretionary spending. When I say discretionary, that means other than Social Security and defense.
Yeah.
Which is, that's not healthy. That obviously, President Bush says it doesn't matter, he's wrong. That does matter. Everybody knows that if you get consumed in interest on your credit cards, you go upside down. You can't keep up with those interest payments, and you ultimately... The way that many people who get caught in that trap, they end up declaring bankruptcy. Well, we don't have to do that. It's the full faith and credit of the United States. But guess who will pay that off? It will be future generations.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks. At least you're aware of it, and I'm glad for that.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm very concerned about it, too.
Well, it seems that, though, see, when we get down to talking about government spending, everybody likes to blame everybody else and talks about the Republicans say the Democrats are the big spenders, and now a lot of Democrats and even some conservative Republicans say, well, no, Republicans, they're big spenders, too. The problem in Washington seems to have been is that everybody ends up getting everything they want. No one's making any sacrifices. The only way that we're going to control spending is by deciding that there's something that we're spending money on that we're either not going to spend the money or we're going to spend less. If you take a look at where the spending is, and the bulk of that does seem to go into things like defense and homeland security, and then very popular social programs like Medicare and Social Security, if you're going to cut spending, where do you do it?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. Social Security and Medicare, those aren't net outlays. They're surpluses. In fact, they mask our true deficit. We're taking in more money for Social Security. That money we should be setting aside to meet that obligation. So if you, we just put it all into one unified budget. If you were to include the Social Security surplus in this budget deficit, it would be well over $600 billion a year. You know, that's a unified budget. But let's look at other forms of spending you have that they've proposed. $1.5 billion for a marriage initiative to teach people about marriage. Now, this wasn't new. They initiated some of this in the last go-around, the last fiscal year. $300 million went to Texas. And you know what they spent it on? Teaching abstinence to divorced people. My federal tax dollars, your federal tax dollars, have already been spent to teach divorced people abstinence. This is clearly outside the realm of government to be doing this. The Mars proposal. This is something President Bush has proposed that will cost, conservatively, $1 trillion. These are the kind of investments I would take that money and invest, as I said, in the hydrogen fuel cell industry. Let's end our addiction to Mideast oil. That is really important from a national security standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, and from a job standpoint. So there's a whole host of spending. The corporate welfare, the energy bill that President Bush proposed, had $20 billion worth of subsidies to the energy industry. ExxonMobil, who was the most profitable company in the world, was getting these subsidies. These are mature industries. This is what they're supposed to do, is do oil and gas exploration. We don't need to give them $20 billion in additional subsidies to do what it is that they're doing. If we want to develop immature technologies like fuel cells and geothermal and wind and all these others, that's fine. There's a purpose there. There's a national purpose. But just giving money to the corporate special interests that President Bush has, the Medicare drug bill, again, almost half of that plan now will end up in the pockets of the private drug plans because that's the way the plan was set up. It wasn't set up to provide the most efficient and least costly prescription drug program to seniors. If they wanted that, they would have allowed the government to negotiate the price of prescription drugs for those seniors in the program. Instead, they specifically forbid the government from negotiating with drug companies. Now, why is that? Why would we, if we have the ability, that's why, you know, everyone talks about Canadian drugs. They're half the cost of U.S. drugs, specifically because the government is allowed to negotiate the price down. Well, in this bill, because the special interests have such a hold on this administration, they specifically forbid it. No negotiations. This, if you just took a look at this whole bill, you could take out lots of spending, and I think you should repeal the tax cuts for those people making over $200,000. Because it's an enormous shift of the tax burden from the very wealthiest to the middle class who can afford at least right now while their jobs are being shipped overseas.
We have several other callers here in line waiting to go, and I will get to them in just a moment, but I think I should introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Nancy Skinner. She is one of seven Democrats that will compete in the March primary. They're seeking their party's nomination to run for U.S. Senate here from the state of Illinois. The state's Republican Senator Peter Fitzgerald is not running again, so we have an open seat. There are seven Democrats. I think there are eight or nine Republicans, and we are going to try to get as many of these people on the program as possible, so you'll have the opportunity to hear from them and also speak with them. I do want to also mention one more time that there'll be two radio debates this week involving Republican and Democratic candidates for the Senate. The first one is tonight at 6:30. This will be the Republican candidates, and then tomorrow night, again, same time, 6:30, we'll have the Democratic candidates. It's live, and you can hear it here on AM 580, also online, WILL.UIUC.edu. Just again, a little bit more about our guest, Nancy Skinner. She hosts a nationally syndicated radio talk program called Good Day USA, which airs on 380 stations across the country, including six in Illinois. Before that, she worked at WLS in Chicago, where she did a talk show beginning in 1997. However, this past summer, when she announced on the program that she intended to run for the Senate, she was fired by WLS. She has a business degree from University of Michigan and also background in environmental consulting. consulting. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana where we are. But there's also that toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is in Bloomington, Illinois, line number 2.
Hello?
Yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a note before I get started that the interest on the national debt is over $800 million a day right now. So a tax cut really was for the wealthy only. For everybody else, when this when we add on to the national debt next year and the interest payments go up, it's actually a tax increase. But my question is about the media, the national media, and whether we can trust the U.S. media or not. There was a report, a BBC report on this very station that you're on right now a couple months ago, where 24 members of a prominent Sunni Muslim family were killed in a supposedly accidental bombing meant for Saddam Hussein at the start of the war. One of the survivors gave an interview to the BBC and said that during the first Gulf War, they were part of what was going to be the uprising. And when that was canceled, they kept their State Department contacts over the years. And before a couple months before the invasion, they got a hold of these State Department people and asked if they could try that again with help from special forces instead of a full-blown invasion. And the word came back, and it was no. And this leads me to believe that they wanted to go in and destruct and reconstruct, because this is a big part of what's going on. And I only heard this story on one channel, never on any other American media. And I would venture to guess that Ms. Skinner probably has never heard the story either.
Yeah, media, you have two parts there.
Can we trust the media?
Media, well, that's the problem. Media reform is top on my agenda, having been in the position I'm in. Let me address your first part of your question, and then I'll get to the media. You mentioned that it's actually a tax increase. In Illinois, just to give you the numbers, 48% of us in Illinois got $100 or less from the Bush tax cut. The top 1% got a $68,000 tax cut. But all of us, if you look at the per capita debt that was added on, $9,000 per person was added on under these Bush fiscal policies.
Yes.
So you might have gotten $100, but there's a $9,000 debt that you've picked up. Now, to the media, which is very, very important, there are 5 media companies in the country right now. And the FCC, Michael Powell, who runs the FCC, earlier this year, last year tried to get through a consolidation to allow these companies to be able to acquire more, in other words, further consolidate. Now, there was a huge outpouring of emotion, both from the right and the left, about this. Millions and millions of letters went into the FCC, 99% of them against it. The House voted 400-20 or something. The Senate was a similar lopsided vote against any further consolidation. President Bush, in this latest omnibus spending bill, slipped it through.
Yes.
It is law. Against the will of both houses of Congress and the overwhelming majority of public opinion, they went through and slipped it through. So what are the repercussions? I think that the mainstream media, have done a disastrous job and continue to do that, reporting on stuff that's so important. War, peace, political matters, the war in Iraq, let's start there. You know, I was on the air in my program, and it was far back as October of last year. We knew that there were several published reports where intelligence agents were saying that the intelligence was being politicized. And we knew, for instance, that the Niger uranium deal was not a valid concern. In fact, I was in the State of the Union, the gallery there in Washington, D.C., when President Bush uttered those now infamous 16 words. And at the time, I knew that it had already been disproven.
Yeah.
So I don't think the media did their job in the run-up to the war. I think they were afraid of being called unpatriotic, so they didn't critically examine the case for war, as I think our politicians did not force them to do, and on a whole host of other areas, like the political realm, in the race for this presidency. Howard Dean, for instance, that they did this with Al Gore. He wore earth tones. He invented the Internet, love story. All this stuff was complete nonsense. Yet they focused on it. They didn't focus on President Bush. Now we're finally hearing, 3 years later, questions about President Bush's military record, that he was not, this has been well documented, did not show up for a year of military service when he was in the Texas Air National Guard. At the same time, all they focused on was Al Gore's earth tones. Howard Dean. They played that speech of his 674 times and took his candidacy out. So I think the media and their role, their oversized role in our political process is a problem. My own race, the Chicago Tribune, has decided not to cover me at all. They have only chosen the five leading contenders, so they will not even mention me and Joyce Washington. Now, 10,000 people put our names on the ballot in Illinois. Joyce Washington ran for lieutenant governor. She's a healthcare executive. I have a presidential award. I'm the most widely heard Democrat in America on radio. Why on earth should the Chicago Tribune make the decision that our voices shouldn't be heard? You're denying information to the voters out there. This is the problem. Media, they focus on who has poll numbers and who has money. How do you get your voice out there? How do you get your voice heard? So I think we need drastic reform of the media, absolutely. And my first bill when I'm elected will be the McCain-Skinner Media Reform Act. I planned it out.
Well, may I say in closing, I think I like your attitude, and I think Democrats, we're usually too nice. We need to fight. We need to stand up and fight this time. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Then I'm your candidate. My website is skinnerthewinner.com. And you can learn much more about me. You don't often get this opportunity, so I thank you for having me today.
Okay, let's go to next caller. It's Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Since you're continuing on various environmental themes, have you heard the latest that our president wants to finance maintenance of the national parks with revenues earned from oil drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge? I heard this morning.
I hadn't heard that, but okay. It doesn't surprise me.
How are you going to get your voice out? I mean, are you also on, for instance, Black Talk Radio up in Chicago? Have they interviewed you?
I'm doing a lot of radio.
Newspapers?
I am. Chicago Tribune has sort of singled, they have the single worst coverage of this race, so I suggest don't bother getting your news from them. You're not getting all the news, so don't bother. I'm going to a Sun-Times endorsement interview a little bit later on this afternoon,
okay.
So they've been much better in reporting on the race. Here's what I'm doing. I am getting outside the big money because you've already seen all these commercials. You're probably seeing them all over downstate of the candidates who have millions and millions of dollars. Most of them don't even show up at debates, by the way. I'm at every senatorial debate and every forum, and by and large, I'm told I win when I'm there. But these folks, the way the process is now, they just rely on polished TV ads. They won't even show up, or if they do, their performance, I'll tell you honestly that they have a hard time. But they have so much money they can go on TV. They're good people. I'm not saying anything about my field of candidates. I think they're good and well-meaning people. That's just how you win in politics these days. But what I'm doing is going outside that. Instead of broadcasting, I'm narrowcasting. And I have a volunteer corps of about 1,000-plus right now people. And what we're doing is at my website, you can sign up, skinofthewinner.com. We have the voter list and phone numbers of all registered voters in Illinois Democrats, and we're calling them personally. Our core is just calling them and introducing me as a candidate, and we're communicating via email in a way that it's not so visible out on your local TV set, but we're out there, so you can sign up and give us your email, and you can get all the issues. We're issuing every couple days a new issue and a solution, and I think they're going to be surprised that we're using novel ways to get around the process.
All right, we'll just keep going. The next caller is in Urbana, also line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, I have two interests. One is, as a Latino, I'm interested in your attitude toward immigration and illegal aliens. And then number two, I'd like you to talk about how you would change the trade treaties, as you mentioned earlier, to make them more friendly to middle-class jobs.
Sure.
Keeping them here.
Well, those two issues are very closely related, and people don't often recognize that. Number one, in terms of, let me take the last question first. In terms of how I specifically would change those trade deals, a lot of candidates, my fellow candidates included, say, well, we just need to make them more fair, and we need to include labor and environmental standards. It's sort of this nebulous statement. Well, that's what they said before they enacted NAFTA, that we need to do this. I think we need specific plans to focus people. And what I would do is redesign these trade agreements, because you're not going to stop trade. That's unrealistic. But I would tie the tariff structure to whether a country is paying a living wage in that country. We all know what the national average living wage is. That data is accumulated by the IMF and the World Bank. And in other words, you would get a preferable tariff if you're paying a living wage. That way, there's an incentive for those wages to rise in those countries. I mean, that's the whole theory of trade, that these people in third world countries would, their wages would rise, and then they could buy our airplanes. But what happened is they're making our airplanes and our computers. And now the service sector is at much as risk as any. You can't call your long-distance phone company or AOL or anything without talking to somebody in Bombay or New Delhi. India has become the new outsourcing land for service sector jobs. So I would, that's exactly what I would do, is to re-engineer those trade agreements. Now, to your first, the first question had to do with immigration. President Bush has recently proposed temporary worker status for illegal immigrants. And I must say I'm very troubled by this proposal. Because, simply because, you can see, David, that I'm very concerned about the exporting of America. So what are we saying to the American worker? We're going to go, we're going to take your blue-collar jobs and ship them to China. We're going to ship your white-collar jobs to India. You're hurting. You're taking a low-paying service sector job now because you've lost your manufacturing job. You can't afford health insurance and a pension now. You don't have, they're not benefits associated with your service sector job. Oh, and by the way, we're going to open the floodgates and allow illegal immigrants to come in and decrease your wages, compete for you in service sector wage jobs. I think there's a problem there, and it's not good for the American worker, and it's not good for the Mexican worker. It all goes back to NAFTA. NAFTA forced constitutional changes, land reform changes that forced the farmers off their fields, off of the, they used to, you know, be self-sufficient, forced them off their fields. Many of these illegal the farmers then went to the maquiladoras and worked there on the border, mostly in U.S.-run companies. But now even three-fifths of those maquiladoras, those U.S. companies, have shifted their jobs to China, where labor is even cheaper. So these people have nowhere to go. Of course, the motivation is to come to the United States and try to earn a living to feed their family. I don't, you know, question the motive. But instead of just the patchwork, it's almost like an indentured servancy. We're going to keep these people here. They'll have no citizenship. Some of these bills are absurd. That doesn't solve the root cause here. How do we make life better for these people in their home countries and for us American workers here? And there is a way to do it. It's just you've got to stand up to the multinationals who have profited from this whole scheme and say, you know, trade and economic development is about improving the quality of life for everyone here on Earth. It's not about just making the super rich even richer.
Well, I certainly agree with that part, at least, but I just want to give you a parting shot. I've heard in a couple different locations that all these many years have accumulated billions of dollars of unclaimed contributions to the Social Security system, as high as $370 billion with a B, dollars. So if you ever get to the Senate, and I think you'd be very influential if you did, I hope you look into that. And those dollars are attributable to those illegal aliens using false Social Security numbers, and maybe that could be directed toward some sort of programs to help them out. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll just keep on going here. We've got about 15 minutes left, and again, maybe I should introduce our guest. We're talking with Nancy Skinner. She's a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. She's one of seven that will compete in the March 16th primary, and one of them then will go out on to represent their party in the general election. We have an open seat here, the seat that's now held by Republican Peter Fitzgerald, and we have a lot of candidates, both Democrats and Republicans, and we will have as many as we can, as many as are willing to be on this program, so that you'll have the same opportunity to ask questions. And we'll just continue with a lot of interest this morning, people who want to talk with the guests. So I'm just going to stay out of the way here and let you do that. The next person up in line is in Chicago, and that is line number four.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a couple of issues that I want to talk about and see what your comments are. The Democrats with almost no exception, seem to be brain dead. They have all sorts of issues facing them, which they don't capitalize on. And one is that on health care, back in 1993, the Congressional Budget Office and Consumers Union, in separate reports, stated that they had studied the health care system in the United States and had determined that with the 40 million people who were roughly uncovered by health insurance, they could cover these people by going on a single-payer plan without costing the United States taxpayer any more money. And, well, that's it. And pay for everyone who is uncovered.
Well, that's an excellent point, and it's not just this is a great area to demonstrate why I'm a different kind of candidate. Because every issue like this, I look at not just the issue, but how are we going to pass these issues? How are we going to win the public's opinion? How are we going to withstand Republican attacks? Because you will remember that Hillary Clinton came up with a very extensive health care solution that would have been much better had we adopted it.
Except that was garbage also.
But no, it wasn't garbage. It was managed care, but using private insurers, but with government controls. What we ended up so that they could not do what many HMOs have done now, which is to limit care. It's just the cheapest cost they can provide. And what happened was the Republicans spent $170 million in attack ads. Remember those Harry and Louise attack ads? They called it socialized medicine. They demonized it, and they killed it. So my plan, I take into consideration the fact that we'll likely face that same line of attack from Republicans this time around with a single-payer universal plan. My plan is completely different. It's a voluntary plan. It's called U.S. Choice for Healthcare because names matter. And it's a voluntary plan that allows the government to compete with private insurers to provide an affordable healthcare premium. Now, how can the government compete? Well, first of all, they have no profit requirement. There's an enormous profit margin in the industry. The costs are lower. Social Security and Medicare about 3% versus 25% in the private industry. And with the pool of risk so large, 43 million Americans, you can offer this plan quite cheaply. Now, how are the Republicans going to demonize a plan called U.S. Choice that's completely voluntary based on free market principles and competition, which is the bedrock of their ideology? The fact is, they can't. If the government can use their power to negotiate an affordable health care plan with private insurers and do it better than the private industry is, because the industry is not delivering or we wouldn't have this many uninsured, why not pursue it? These are the kinds of big, bold, new ideas that Democrats need. That Republicans did this 25 years ago. They talked about tort reform and the Contract on America. These were visionary things that today, you know, privatization of Social Security, which I fear have come to pass. We need the same approach in the Democratic Party.
And again, let's go to our next caller, and that will be in Edgar County, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning, Nancy.
Yep.
Good morning.
I used to listen to you on WLS, even though there's great programming on WILL at the same time. So I listen one ear to you and one ear to
WILL. I don't want to compete with my host here. Thank you.
But since then, I have to tell you, I've gone strictly to WILL. But anyway, historically, do you think that this whole thing with Bush started in the mid-90s with what David was discussing in the earlier hour about the project for the new American century?
Oh, yeah, the Iraq thing.
Yeah.
Wow, that's how much foresight. Absolutely, and I think Paul O'Neill has pretty much proven that in the latest book that he participated in. He said that in the very first, I interviewed him the other day, Ron Suskin, who was the author of the book, in the very first National Security Council meeting, very first one, in the first month,
right,
they got hold of notes from that meeting, and it said, the post-Saddam Iraq rebuilding plan, secret. So they were planning on overthrowing them, and if you follow the Century for a New America or the Project for a New American Century, you have Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney, all these guys calling for exactly that. We have to get rid of
But they weren't politically appealing. And so they used the Wizard of Oz and put him up in front of the curtain.
Oh, sure, right, President Bush. And 9/11 gave them the...
That was the fulcrum.
Yeah, what they needed, you can't just take office and say, we're going to go in and take Saddam out.
Right.
And I think this has been pretty well established that Wesley Clark said he got a call that night on September 11th saying, you've got to tie this to Saddam Hussein, or to just to Saddam Hussein, when he said, I don't, show me the evidence. What evidence is there? So absolutely, I think that this was a plan, and then they believed that democracy would be a domino in the Middle East, the domino theory, and it was based on conviction, not necessarily years and years of diplomacy, intelligence, history, and thought. It was the war hawkish conviction of this small group of neocons.
So in other words, Bush is a sophist. The ends justify the means.
It's hard to say. Paul O'Neill said President Bush in his book was pretty disconnected from what was going on. So I don't think, I think that he's a likable guy. I don't have anything against him personally, but it sounded to me like someone, this is a Republican cabinet member who knew him very well and is a lifelong friend of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And he said he was just amazed. He actually said that President Bush at a cabinet meeting was like a blind person in a room full of deaf people.
Yeah.
But and that was his joke. But that he was so disconnected. So that's the problem. You don't want someone so disconnected that they can't see this maneuvering that was happening. They cut Colin Powell out. Colin Powell should have been the moderating force, but somehow he was completely cut out.
Why hasn't he quit?
I don't know.
He's been cut at every angle.
I think the man has tremendous loyalty, and he wants to serve his country. I respect Colin Powell completely. I don't know how he could have ever gone to the UN Security Council with the intelligence information he had in light of what we now know. There were no biological trucks. There were no unmanned aerial vehicles capable of delivering poisons to the U.S. shores. None of this stuff existed. How did Colin Powell get duped into saying this before the whole world?
We just have about 5 minutes left. I hope the last caller will forgive me. I'd like to try and include at least one more. And so let's go to Dwight, Illinois. That's line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for Nancy.
Yes.
I believe I was listening here for a short time, and there was a gentleman that called about the tax cuts, how unfair they were. And my response is to that. Are you there?
Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Recently in a Bloomington Pantograph, there was an article written by Carson Wagner, and he's a professor of finance, insurance, and law at Illinois State University. He put down in paper in the print concerning what the tax cuts were and how they affected most of the people in the United States in their classes. That's the first time that I've had a chance to see how this works, and it was in print, and I believe this gentleman is probably pretty knowledgeable, so you're probably not aware of this article, but the title of it is Bush Tax Cuts Are Both Fair and Just. And you might bone up on that sometime. It's all down there in black and white, and at the bottom of his article, he says, I believe President's Bush's new tax rate of 35% is fair and just, and added incentives will go a long way to close a serious budget deficit. So, and it opened my eyes to how we are, all our tax brackets are going to receive some benefit from this. So that.
Well, here's a trick that many people use, and so you have to look at lots of analyses. President Bush talks about the average tax cut being $1,000. When you average, Robert Reichle says he's about 5 feet tall. He says, be careful with averages. Me and Senator Bill Bradley average 6 feet. You can't use averages when you're talking about these tax cuts. You have to use the median tax cut. The median tax cut, 48% of us in Illinois got $100. So you can't average in. If you use averages, you're taking the $68,000 tax cut that the top 1% of Illinois taxpayers use, and you're averaging that with the masses, and so that number is going to be much higher. I suggest you look at other research. CTJ.org, thorough analysis and lots of links on this. I just can't find any economist who says that this was distributed fairly across the different income tax levels.
Well, he does cover all the tax brackets in here in the various amounts that people make, and it's I think this person is probably a credible person being from our local area. I won't say any more, and thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And have they worked? That's the question. President Bush says tax cuts would create jobs. That's why he said we did them. Well, we've had three tax cuts, we've lost 3 million jobs, and we have a $10 trillion deficit. So if that's his idea of success, I'd hate to see his idea of failure. The tax cuts do not increase jobs. If you want to create jobs, you create specific incentives for companies, U.S. companies that hire U.S. workers, and not machinery, because sometimes machinery incentives are just used. I'm not saying you eliminate that, but that's not what you focus on. Machinery incentives eliminate workers.
We're going to have to stop, I'm afraid. We have some other callers we can't take. We've just used the time. I want to say to our guest, Nancy Skinner, a Democratic candidate for Senate, one of seven who will be competing in the primary. Ms. Skinner, thank you very much for joining
us.
Thank
you. Can I give my website, SkinnerTheWinner.com?
Yes, you may. You certainly.
And March 16th is the election. That's my birthday. So I hope people give birth to a whole new generation of Democratic leaders.
All right. And for people who are interested in hearing more from Democratic candidates, obviously we're going to try to have as many of them as we can here on the program. But there will be this week a debate. In fact, there'll be two debates, one involving the Republicans, the others the Democrats. You can hear the Republican Senate candidates debate tonight at 6:30 here on our station, and then the Democrats, the same kind of debate, then tomorrow night at 6:30. That'll be live here on AM 580, also online, will.uiuc.edu.